My name is Angela. I am a senior here at BC, actually studying environmental geoscience and international studies. So my big question is that I think a lot of people haven't really been educated on the effects of climate change as a scientific issue, and I think it's especially dangerous when people in power kind of claim that climate change isn't an issue, and we've seen that in North Carolina. They kind of issued a law saying that, like, sea level isn't going to affect North Carolina and whatnot. We can't include it in our legislation. So I kind of wanted to kind of hear what you have to say about, especially people in power that don't believe in it. And as an individual, how do you begin to affect those people with the influence? Because I do think that there's a difference there. So thank you.
A great question. In 2 weeks, we're going to have to actually, there's going to be a bit of a referendum on whether climate change is a hoax or not on the American elections. And that's a pretty stark distinction, right? And people are going to have to make a choice about what their congressman, they should know what their congressman thinks, congressperson thinks, what their senator thinks, what their civil council thinks. So you be sure to find out, and I don't just mean the presidential elections, I mean every way down the ballot, you should know what a candidate believes about climate change and what they're ready to do to make significant changes in the political world. And by that I mean Boston. You're right on the ocean. It's not going to go well for Boston, Los Angeles, or, you know. So you should know. It has to affect the city council, has to decide, right? Do you ban plastic bags? Do you ban these little plastic bottles made out of petroleum? I mean, those decisions, the preceding decisions, all the way up the line to the presidency. So know your positions, and when you know their positions, be prepared to act as a citizen. And if people are rejecting the science at this point, I think as a scientist you have to say it's unacceptable. It's just unacceptable. It took a very long time, for instance, to change people's ideas about smoking. But they're totally changed. I grew up at a meeting like this. When I went to college, people would smoke in lecture halls. On a renter, I really loved her. She smoked and she gave a lecture, right? Mm-hmm. That's just gone. And people are like, oh, that'll never change. And people's personal life. So I believe change is enormously possible. So that's one thing. Think and act as a citizen and do that. Also, your life is a sign. Everything you do is a sign, right? So if I say, drink bottled water on campus, if I carry around my little thermos, it's a sign to people, and you explain why you do it. And so these are not happy choices. I do miss me, but it's a sign that I don't. It's only, and people ask me why, I say it's because of climate change. 65% of my carbon burden involves me. So yeah, I can't do it. And make your life a sign. Make your life a moral activity. And don't be so righteous about it. Just be straightforward about it. So that's one thing, both personal, political, everything has to happen at the same time. But you know, science is engaged in a great dispute. Will we believe in facticity? Is facticity going to be how we run the organization of our world? And can we do that at the same time as being, you know, believers in God? It's a very interesting question. Okay. What not be?
Hi, thank you so much for your talk. It's very captivating. I am a member of a group called Climate Justice at Boston College. And we are basically, among other things, a group of students who believes that it is our responsibility to interrupt the status quo, as you mentioned, to interrupt the monolithic top-down power at universities, including this one, to interrupt the goal of growing the endowment at whatever cost. So for 4 years now, going on 4 years, we have been urging the administration and the Board of Trustees to divest from violence, to divest from the fossil fuel industry. And we have been met with deaf ears for 4 years now. And I think that is unacceptable, especially at a Jesuit university that purports to espouse these ideals, these values of social justice. And even with the Pope's encyclical coming out and saying that it's basically a sin to not act. And it's not even bold action. It's not even, it won't make a splash, we know, but this is just, it's too late even now, but we've been asking for 4 years. So I guess...
there's no question.
Yes, this is a question, but this is, I think, context is very important. So I would love to ask, what would you do if you were us? What more can we do? How can, should we appeal to the social Catholic teaching? We've tried that. We've appealed, you know, to the Pope's teachings, and we've not had any luck. So I would love...
I, as a person, absolutely believe that we should, the university should not be investing in coal. I think it's ridiculous. The academic senate of our equestrian, where the president has taken a stand with our students and the faculty and students of both the board of trustees via resolution and whatever the democratic process we have, that we don't support it. After carefully looking at the business plan, and even our business people say it's just a bad investment. It's just a stupid way. Invest in Silicon Valley, not in coal. It's not a for Kellogg. So, and that didn't work either. So it takes a long time to change people's minds. Because it takes a long time to change people's minds. And it's very tragic what's going to happen to the people who make a life based on passing to West Coal from the ground and have generation after generation. It's sad. They're going to have to do something else because we already have enough mind fossil fuels to raise the planet by 3 degrees, and we have a Paris Agreement that we agree to that says it's impossible to use it. So you can't both have a Paris Agreement that will become worth the law and the industry of corruption. So it's all straight up corruption, of course. And I do believe that inevitably that's pure economics of that. Do we need to find another source of energy? Absolutely. Because we need very smart, thoughtful plan about how to make that transition that doesn't exist yet. And that's going to be a huge challenge. And the answer isn't, well, we're going to like live like, you know, impoverished, you know, parents. That's not going to happen, right? You are going to move forward in history. How we move forward is important. And all you can do is keep using arguments. All I got is like as a philosopher, right? It's got moral suasion. You don't really have anything else. And don't be shocked that in 4 years, is my assumption. I think it might take a longer time. It doesn't mean you don't make the argument. You keep making the argument over and over and over. And back it up. Back it up. Work on other things. Bottle of water should be served. There should be a bottle of water on the table. Why? The water, is it safe that comes out of a tap? Like, what's that about? Right? Why is there meat served in college cafeterias? Why is meat ever served? Things that are like, you know, really the football team, hot dog, that business, do you need plastic bags? So look at your own practice. Ask them to do their own practice. Do not involve the board of trustees whatsoever. But the practice of a life goal that you're creating here, those things can be changed. And that's a pristine model of green behavior. Right? And it's really hard, by the way. I couldn't convince the AR not to serve you. When that's done, then you can make a stronger case for integrity. It might back those actions. Back those words.
Thank you very much for a very compelling and dashing presentation. I'm a little worried about the embedded theories within it, though, and I'm curious about how you examine them, especially the embedded theory of system, the embedded theory of time, and the embedded theory of agency. Suppose we said, for example, that the system is more complex than we thought, and that it's bigger. And that it's much later than we thought. The embedded period of time is such that the window of opportunity may have already closed. And therefore, the embedded theory of agency, that it really matters what we do, may be sadly naive in the sense that you were suggesting toward the end of your talk that if we do something now, things can be turned around. Al Gore just last week suggested that the vote is important coming up as you seconded. In the tones that if we voted correctly in November, we could save Florida. He actually was in Florida when he said this.
Yeah, probably not.
And not only probably not, we know for certain that we cannot.
Yeah.
Right? So you're accepting, in a sense, a diminished embedded theory of system, namely that we're part of something much bigger, that we probably have very little agency to change. What we're beginning to experience now is the 120-year delay in the carbon that was released in the 19th century, right? Nothing in relation to what China or India has started to release. In other words, aren't we building, as Al did with his slideshow and everything else, a false sense of optimism that is going to be just overwhelmed in tsunami-like proportions by despair? And at that point, what does religion have?
So I have two answers for you. Answer one, to be a Jew / Cubs fan is to believe in total impossibility. So I don't know. I know systems are so totally unpredictable. And everything I read shows it's way too late. Like I said, choices my grandparents made are the ones that affect us now. Right? And we haven't even seen what. And that's why, no, I don't think it's going to be possible to live in Florida or to live in Los Angeles coast, Boston. I mean, God knows what Boston will look like here from my hills or something. But it's really like, if you think about it, and if you read the science, it is terrible, terrible. Now, I live in the upper Midwest, which there's going to be winners and losers, and it's a little better. We have one-fifth of the world's fresh water and land, and so we'll be inundated by refugees. The Fertile Crescent was destroyed several years ago, and just went, whipped off, and then we didn't even notice until people flooded into the cities into Aleppo. And now we notice, oh, whoops, there's no Fertile Crescent for them to go back to. That's like the critical civilization. Major drop. They can't, the water table is destroyed. So, already, if you pay attention, so that's one thing. We shouldn't say it can be turned around. Because, like I say, it can't be turned around. But it can be slowed. It can be mitigated. We can vote for things that allow us to live more or less decently. For the poorest people to live more or less decently. And that's my second. Religion can do one thing that nobody else, no other social system, no other economic system can do. It's a theopolitical imperative of hospitality. And really, that's not in any other system that says, we have to take someone into your house. We have to take them in. That's the part of the Pope's message about the Syrian refugees. It's really even more interesting than the analysis of Tulsi. By the way, these are our people. Take them into your home. And when 65 million refugees just in one year, last year, have to be uprooted in place, you can see the dislocation. That's what Brooke said was about. You can see the dislocation. And it's going to have to be people of faith who take people in on faith. And that's what religion does, is hospitality. That's another paper. I was read that paper. But the answer to this question is only hospitality. We're going to have to find room in our lives and in our countries for people who live around the coast and around most of the belt of the equatorial belt. Because it's just not going to be a habitable. It's not going to be habitable. Where do we expect people to come? If not to our groups, not to our Montana, if not to our North Dakota. So we have to figure that out, and that's why politics is still important, because we're going to have to allocate resources to make that possible. So when, you know, when Phoenix blinkers out, that, you know, we're going to have to figure that out. And only the religious theorist has an answer to what you do. There's really nothing in the marketplace that says you have to take somebody into your house. I've never found it.
Well, there's an interesting aspect to that that's ambivalent, because religions, you may have noticed, around the world, they're also being used to define boundaries and to say who's inside and who's outside. So what you have there is an implicit theory of community that transcends religion. I don't see how you can celebrate it at the same time.
I am optimistic, and I think you can. I think religions, by and large, taken as a whole, have done, you know, there's been some tragic exceptions, right? Fundamentalisms of all sorts. But I think, in general, they offer enormous sources for compassion response. And in general, I've been more on the side of compassion response.
Can we take one more question? A brief question? I saw one in the back. Over here?
You take two questions.
Yes, two questions.
And we take both questions in the back.
Okay, good.
Hi, so I'm Amber. I'm also in climate justice with Joan. And I know you suggested a few ways that we could each take individual action. For example, EcoPledge is another group on campus which has been working to increase recycling and that sort of thing. But we were wondering just the broader question of how we as BC students can take disruptive civil action to really create systematic change.
And second question.
Was there a second? Oh, yes, good. Cheers.
Thank you. Yeah, so I was just wondering, like, you know, as a college student, you know, you say you live in this beautiful place, but I think the average salary coming out of college is like $40,000. And let's say you're saddled with $100,000 in student loans. How do you justify spending $10 to $15 on a more healthy meal that's, you know, non-meat versus the $2 meat? Like $2 burger, I'm just thinking that as one example, but like in general, these choices are more expensive. Just because we live in a beautiful place doesn't mean that those are choices that we have. And then how, and if we're not taking that, are we sinning ourselves in a way? So this kind of my question for one of your choices that you said.
So the answer is happy meals are cheaper, but because the externalities are not, you're not paying for the externalities now, today. You are paying for the externalities. Boston's underwater and you have no house. That's what you're paying then. So that's one answer. And in fact, it's a false choice. It's not like, you know, it's not like gourmet, fancy schmancy, expensive meals versus cheap meat. You're very capable of eating a plant-based yet inexpensive diet. It's not. And that's really possible. One of my favorite practices at the University of Virginia was the faculty would have, once a week, they would have a potluck dinner. It was rice and beans and vegetables. That was it. So, I grew up in the 60s. The diggers used to feed thousands and thousands of us at the demonstrations. It was rice and beans and greens. And we, with us, we survived. So it's not, I think that's, when people say that, I think it's a bit of a false choice. Because there are other ways to live that are not, that aren't gourmet, fancy, excellences. I know it's very tempting to have those. I know there can be, it's not fair to most people in the world who don't have access to fresh fruits and vegetables, but it's something worth working, something worth, really worth it. And social, if no one buys that stuff from McDonald's, then we'll start selling more reasonable food for people to buy. That's hard. I know it's hard. I know what a sacrifice it is to eat boring rice and beans, because it's hard. Hence the term sacrifice. If we're not willing to do it, then what are we asking the Board of Trustees to do if you're not willing to do it? You have to really willing to put your life on the line. When Mario Savio said, put your body in the machine. Okay. Tom Hayden just passed away this week. Stop the war in Vietnam. We weren't kidding around. I don't know if other people
my age, I spent a lot of time in jail. I dropped out of college, spent a lot of time in jail. Protesting. It was not make my parents happy at all, right? And it was significant. It was living collectively. It was significant sacrifices. It was a summer eating nothing with peanut butter. It was not a trivial, these were trivial choices. If you're really serious about it, simple disobedience, it's not, you know, a part-time hobby. It's really being serious about it. Do I think you should drop out of school? No, I did that. It was really, really hard. Not, you know, to crawl back. But I learned a lot. Here I am, a professor, so it wasn't all bad. I think radical political action has to be well organized. It has to be self-situated. I think the reason there's no pipeline was because there was, Bill McKibben was willing to make Organization 350. Was willing to say, we're going to stand in front of the White House, we're going to always protest this pipeline, and then eventually the entire Democratic Party said, okay, we agree. Right? But that's, I now believe much more in standing straight up politics, right? Having elections and making, enacting that. But I do think that you have to view that there's times when things are fair and you have to work to change them. Right? And you have to give voice. Rehan, she'll tell you, you have to go into the public space. Make your argument publicly, make yourself clear, and be willing to be rumored. I mean, that's all we have, is the ability to say that. We don't have anything else. We have, but it's an enormous power. It's an enormous power. But look, you know, for the war in Vietnam, we really wanted to stop it. We all collectively around the country walked out, stopped every campus. And Kent State happened, it was because people were willing to not go to class, not graduate. Failed utterly. You know, didn't go to class. That was it. We were done. And that radical action was needed to stop the war. We needed to stop the war because our friends were being not, they weren't hungry, they were being shipped off to Vietnam. So, but it was a very, very angry and desperate time, the real way to stop, to really stop the war. That's my era. And you know, we had an organization called Students for Democratic Society, SDS. And for a long time, it was a democratic organization. And there, if you read the Port Huron Statement, something I strongly recommend every college student should read the Port Huron Statement. It's not, you know, socialism. It's how to be a good democratic citizen and how to think through what laws. I love thinking through that question. I don't know what it will take to do climate change in the to confront it in a way that this particular war was confronted by the draft. And one other thing is, we made mistakes. I don't know if we're right or wrong about nuclear power. I know we created the movement to stop nuclear power, which meant that all research on what to do with ways to stop as well. Maybe that was wrong. I don't know yet. Stopping the draft was really, seemed like totally the right thing to do. I'm not so sure that was now, because it created a kind of class and racial segregation in the army that's tremendously, I'm not sure about that. You have to really be willing to also make a big mistake. And we live in a world where a big mistake like climate change is unacceptable.
If you're a student and you're interested in getting engaged with some of these issues, we certainly encourage you to take a look at groups like EcoPledge and Climate Justice in D.C. A few of the folks from those groups have agreed to be present in the back of the room for a few minutes to hear, and elsewhere there's several have spoken, so if you'd like to get involved, please see some of those folks afterwards. But most importantly, I want to thank you, Roy, for bringing your prophetic voice to this campus and to helping us think very seriously about what this means in our lives. Thank you very much.